The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Theresa May has summoned her Brexit war cabinet to thrash out the government's position on the EU trade talks. So, a mere 18 months after the referendum result, could the government be about to decide its preferred future relationship with the EU? Don't hold your breath. Meanwhile, new leaked documents showed how the EU plans to punish Britain for any infringements during the transition phase. And 100 years since the Representation of the People Act, we hear from Labour's Dawn Butler on advances in equality for women and the work still to do.
We should recognise the struggle that has taken place over the centuries, but we should never be complacent because we still have a long way to go.
But first, joining me in the studio are the Guardian leader writer Anne Perkins, from the think tank Open Europe, Arti Shankar, and on the line from Brussels, our correspondent Jennifer Rankin. Anne, as we record this, Theresa May is preparing to gather her Brexit war cabinet for the second day in a row. It seems as if their main enemy at the moment is each other.
Yes, it gives a whole new meaning to war cabinet, doesn't it? The point is that Theresa May, ever since the vote, has seen her principal job as honouring the result of the referendum, but at the same time holding her party together when her party was deeply divided on it. And by trying to hold the party together, she's avoided making any commitments. That's simply created space for the two factions, and they are very deeply embedded and entrenched now, for the two factions to fight each other and to vie like angry children for Mrs. May's support. And she's got to the point, although we're told it's not after all going to happen this week, where she has simply got to decide exactly what Britain's going to look like after Brexit. She's got to answer the question that wasn't on the ballot paper.
And Arti, the particular iteration of this that we've been sort of rehearsing over the last week or so has been the customs union, hasn't it? And, you know, which obviously wasn't on the ballot paper. And, you know, Theresa May has ruled out staying in the customs union and she's ruled out staying in a customs union. But we hear that the Whitehall civil servants are sort of desperately trying to find a way through this. And we're now looking at some sort of other arrangement. Is there a sort of clever compromise here, or do we just need to sort of come down on one side or the other and be in or out?
Well, I think we do have to come down on one side or the other. We do have to be in or out of the customs union or a customs union, whatever that arrangement might be later on. But when we talk about the customs union and the possibility of what the government has been putting forward, this customs arrangement, they're two very separate things. A customs arrangement wouldn't be staying in the customs union by other means. It really doesn't have a legal definition. It can be whatever customs deals or facilitation agreements the government chooses to agree with the EU. It's a very separate thing to being in that strict structure of a customs union.
It's pretty clear we're going to be outside that, isn't it? I mean, there's a strong constituency in Parliament for remaining inside, particularly on the Labour backbenches and the Tory backbenches. But the government's position seems to be fairly clear, doesn't it, that we're outside?
I think so, yeah. The government's position has been clear on this kind of nominally since the Lancaster House speech. But we are hearing, yes, more calls from the backbenchers. We're hearing more calls from Labour. We're hearing more calls from business. The CBI this week has once again reiterated they want a customs union with the EU, despite the fact the government put out on Monday that this has been ruled out in all possible shapes and forms. So clearly there is still a debate going on here. This has not been taken off the public debate table, even if the government has ruled it out. And I think to reach the end of this kind of circular argument, the government needs to start putting out real argument. It needs to start saying, yes, there will be costs to leaving the customs union. Yes, we do address that there are business concerns in doing this. And these are the steps we're going to take to mitigate that. If they don't address those concerns, then we will continue in this circular argument.
And that's part of the problem, isn't it, Anne? Is a sort of unwillingness to talk about trade-offs and to say, OK, we're going to accept some economic costs to doing this because we think it's important for these political reasons.
That's it. You get the sense that there's a terrible reluctance to address the real consequences of this decision. And we keep, you know, every day for the last week, we've seen a little bit more evidence that on the best available forecasts, this is going to be very painful. That means there's got to be a serious rival offer to make that pain worthwhile. And nobody, except for perhaps James Dyson, has come up with a really convincing and persuasive answer to how Britain will look outside, completely outside, all the main trading arrangements with Europe, and particularly how it's going to play for those people who felt that the economy had, was functioning without their interests at heart anyway, which is why they, largely why they voted Brexit at all. It looks as if we're going to do this huge act of self-harm for the one thing that is achievable outside the single market, which is to end free movement of people. And it seems like a very, very high price to pay.
It's interesting, Artie, we don't seem to be talking about free movement quite so much, do we? We seem to have, the government's delayed its immigration paper. We're still waiting to see what an immigration regime might look like outside of the EU. That's an aspect of this that we talked about a lot in the immediate aftermath of the referendum and we haven't heard so much about since, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very striking that this has kind of fallen off out of the debate. It's something, you're absolutely right to say, it's clearly been pointed out as a key driver of the Leave vote. It's clearly a concern of Leave voters, but equally of some Remain voters. I mean, Open Europe did a public attitudes survey on this very, very recently, and we found that there are, you know, there is more nuance in the public debate about attitudes towards immigration than is often kind of portrayed in the media or in politics or in just discussions about immigration. And we really need to start having that conversation sooner rather than later. And if you look at the report from yesterday's Brexit Cabinet Committee meeting, we hear again that kind of cabinet ministers are falling in line behind this idea that there shouldn't be a preferential treatment for EU nationals coming to the UK. But there was no firm agreement. There was no, the Times reported that they didn't get into the weeds about it. They didn't have any rows about it because they're not trying to come to conclusions here. Someone else suggested that these cabinet committee meetings end in a summary of points rather than a conclusion and a trade-off between the different points of view that are put forward. And that really needs, we need to move forward from that point.
That's right. I think somebody said to me yesterday, absolutely nothing was agreed, which doesn't strike me as encouraging. Jennifer, how on earth does this look from Brussels? What on earth are the EU27 supposed to make of us when we don't seem to be able to decide our own position in detail?
Well, it's a good question. And for the officials and diplomats sitting in Brussels, it all looks like a horrible mess. EU negotiators have been saying for months that the UK needs to make a choice. It needs to decide whether it wants to be in or out of the single market, in or out of the customs union, and that there aren't halfway house options on the table. And now there's growing impatience at this reluctance to make a choice. And it really, it puts into perspective, thinking back to when the negotiations started last summer and the Brexit Secretary David Davis came to Brussels promising the row of the summer, saying that talks must accelerate to the second phase about trade, when in fact we find that even after the decision in December that talks could move on to trade, that the British government has nothing to say. And this is causing growing impatience in Brussels and a sense that the negotiations are not going to get very far.
And in the details that were leaked this week about the demands of the 27 for the transition period, looked as though, or one of the things that was seized upon by the papers and by your colleague Dan Boffey was the idea that the EU would like to be able to punish us or like to be able to sort of withdraw full access to the single market instantaneously if there's some sort of infringement during that transition period. What lies behind that? What's the worry that's driving that?
Well, there are two points I'd make about that transition document that we saw. And the first point is that by and large, it was very much a rewrite of the negotiating guidelines that had been handed to Michel Barnier the week before, the EU's chief negotiator. So there was very little in there that we hadn't seen already. But of course, as you rightly say, there was that one very interesting point about this so-called punishment mechanism for the UK to be excluded from parts of the single market if it failed to uphold EU laws during the transition. And this of course, got a lot of attention. But it is worth bearing in mind on that score that the written into the EU process and treaties, and in fact, most international agreements, you have some kind of redress when one party breaks the rules. So in the case of the EU, it works on the basis of countries being taken to the European Court of Justice when they break the rules. But in the case of the Brexit transition, that won't work because the transition will be less than 2 years. And it can take as long as 2 years to get a ruling from the European Court. So that's why the EU side wants to come up with a mechanism to ensure that the British government will comply with EU law and will not start backsliding on standards, whether that's sort of a bonfire regulations, environmental regulations or worker protection that would then put European companies at a disadvantage because they may have given access because the UK will retain access to the single market during the transition, but potentially would not have the same incentive to meet EU rules. So that's why they're really looking at this kind of mechanism. And we don't know yet exactly what that will look like. And I could imagine the worry for the UK side might be that then you'll have the EU authorities in Brussels acting as judge and jury, and you could find that the arrangement is less attractive from a UK point of view than the European Court of Justice that everyone is so keen in the government to get away from.
Mm. Anne?
I wonder if there aren't two things going on here in terms of the response to a document that, as you say, Jennifer, was actually dealing with a practical problem that might arise during the transition period. And that's the way it's been translated in the British press. And it seems to me that there's something else going on in the way that every step of these negotiations is reported. And that's about ensuring that if there is a second referendum, which looks very unlikely, or even a parliamentary vote, there will be no backsliding in public opinion, that the ground is being prepared to make it clear that the EU is the enemy, that we're continuing the referendum campaign by other means. And I think this is a very alarming development. I feel that we ought to be working as hard as we can to make sure the counter-argument is heard as well.
And Artie, there's a feeling, isn't there, that Anne's right there, that it's very highly charged, a lot of the rhetoric about this, certainly, you know, in and around Westminster. You've got these, it's incredibly strong language being used. You know, Jacob Rees-Mogg's been talking about vassal states. And Nigel Farage popped up yesterday talking about Vichy France, which didn't seem terribly helpful. When you look at public opinion, you were talking about surveying public opinion and views on migration and so on. Is it as highly charged on some of these issues or on the sort of practicalities of it? Is there a way through this that doesn't involve us having to, you know, pretend we're rerunning the Second World War or goodness knows what else?
I'm sure there is an element of this polarisation in public opinion as well. But certainly when we looked at the immigration question, you can draw a lot more nuance out than we put forward in this normal sort of dichotomy, us versus them. But what I would say is on this point of kind of putting the EU's punishment clause more in context is part of the reason why we can discuss this in isolation as the EU punishing us is because we haven't yet put our position on the table. And Greg Hands yesterday, an interview with Andrew Neil, didn't do a very good job of moving that argument any further. But some of the things that I assume are quite objectionable about this punishment clause is that, I mean, so far we don't have an idea of how proportional that will be if the UK diverges from some small technical regulation in one area. Will all of our access to the EU market be cut off? And equally, will this be reciprocal? And part of the reason we don't know the answer to that question is because we're reading the EU's negotiating directives. What are the UK's? What are we going to say? I imagine a sanction clause, Jennifer's right, is likely to be included in any of these agreements.
On both sides, you'd
say. On both sides. And so the UK should be putting forward, I imagine, if this is going to be included, this idea of reciprocity. Well, then in that case, if the EU takes a position that is discriminatory towards the UK, perhaps during the transition period, the UK should also have the means by which to impose a sanction on the EU. And that then becomes a lot less of a charged debate about the EU punishing us.
Mm. And part of the reason it's so charged is, as you said earlier, is because of these factions within the Tory party. How secure do you think Theresa May is? We had a week or so ago, we had a bit of a wobble, didn't we? And we had the sort of spectator saying lead or go. And there's like a lot of jockeying going on.
There was the really sustained push in its own way, not unlike the attempt to unseat Gordon Brown at the end of his prime ministership, or indeed the attempt to launch a coup against Corbyn. It is an exceedingly, if you aren't prepared to be clear yourself, you put yourself in an extremely difficult position. You've got the Brexiters in cabinet who are very aware of Jacob Rees-Mogg and others outside sniping at them. I mean, the exchange between Jacob Rees-Mogg and David Davis in the Select Committee a week ago, which is when vassal state was first raised as a term of abuse, was a deliberate firing across the bows by an outside Brexiter against somebody who was supposed to be advancing the Brexit cause in government. And in cabinet so far, progress has been glacially slow, but nonetheless, they have managed to sell a transition deal. They have managed to accept, they have managed to persuade Boris Johnson and Liam Fox that there will be payment for leaving. So
nobody's walked out the door.
Nobody has yet walked out the door. Now, I think she's coming to the point where she's going to have to let, she's going to have to risk people going. But a week ago, I thought she looked her hold on power looked really perilous, and yet she survives another week, and she. You know, you feel the knuckles aren't quite so white.
Mm. And part of the problem, Artie, is that anyone taking over would still face this kind of structural problem, wouldn't they? That there's a really knotty negotiating challenge to undertake here. And your own political party is deeply divided about it. Whoever took over would face that same problem, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. There is perhaps an argument that one of the things that would make this easier is if there was more direction, if there was more political leadership coming out of government. So if we move back to the customs union debate, you know, Open Europe does support the idea of leaving the customs union. That doesn't mean not acknowledging that there will be costs to leaving the customs union, but it's about delivering the message about why that would be necessary and what we can do to mitigate against those costs. And the government really needs to start doing that. Theresa May, as Prime Minister, really needs to start doing that.
Mm. Tell us what the benefits are while you're on the subject. Why should we leave? It's about our enhanced relationship with other markets in the world, isn't it?
I think it is, yes. It is absolutely to do with trade with other non-EU markets in the world. And the Trade Secretary isn't wrong when he says that those are the growth markets of the future. But equally, this is, and perhaps even more importantly, this is a political question. If we stay in the customs union or a customs union with the EU for the long term, we have to accept that we are delegating our international trade policy to the EU, who will have the right to sell our market access in their own trade deals without us getting reciprocal access to other trading partners. And it will mean, if you look at other customs unions that the EU has agreed with third-party countries, it won't mean as frictionless trade as we currently have as a member of the customs union. And if we want that, it will mean signing up to a lot of the EU's regulatory model, a lot of the EU's decision-making structures, and turning ourselves into a rule taker for the long term. And that is not, I would argue, a politically sustainable position for the UK to be in. And that is the reason why we would have to leave.
The thing that I always find confusing about the argument for being the pro case for being outside the customs union is that Germany trades with China to a much greater extent than we do from within the EU. Dyson trades extensively with China. I've yet to see persuasive evidence that we're missing out because we can't strike our own trade deals, that we'd get better trade deals as UK PLC than we get as part of one of the 28.
Artie, answer that one.
So you touched on an important point that Germany does trade more with China than the UK does. So all of these, you know, all of the idea of what international or UK trade policy will look like post-Brexit shouldn't just revolve around the customs union. We have other levers that we need to pull that don't necessarily have to do with our membership of the EU or the EU's customs union. We can do far more in terms of trade promotion, in terms of export capacity than we do currently. That is a fair argument. But equally, I think if you look at how the EU constructs its trade agreements, it is a collective 28 member state interests fighting against each other to get to a final trade deal. That intuitively slows down the way you do trade agreements, and it also means that you have a lot more compromises internally, and therefore all the kind of conclusions that you strike with a third party country won't necessarily be of benefit to one member state in particular. And there is an argument that the UK, in doing this by itself independently, will be able to strike trade agreements quicker and more suited to its own interests. I accept that argument, I do. But you are right to point out that there are other levers that we should be looking towards, not just our membership of the customs union.
And perhaps supporting our manufacturing base might
Absolutely.
Be a good start.
Mm.
Jennifer, Artie was talking a little bit there about sort of cross-cutting interests that you sometimes get. At what point are we going to start to see the EU27 having diverging interests about what relationship they'd like to have with Britain in future? Or will they continue to maintain this sort of amazing solidarity, collectivity that we've seen so far?
Yes, well, we haven't seen the signs of divergence yet, but in a sense, it's easier for the EU27 to maintain that unity because there isn't a proposal on the table from the UK to divide them. But I did just want to make a couple of points on the customs union as well. And first of all, just partly in response to Artie's points, I think it's also worth bearing in mind that trade deals are a question of size as well. And while it's true that the EU always has long drawn out debates about how to reach a compromise and and inevitably there are lots of different interests at play, it also has the advantage of being a market currently of 510 million people. That will obviously reduce when the UK leaves, but it's still going to be a massive player compared to the UK, and the UK will be a much smaller player trying to negotiate, say, with the US, which has a population greater. And I think these things do matter in international trade negotiations. And the second thing I wanted to say about the customs union is Ireland, which we haven't talked about at all so far, but which is a really critical issue that comes to the heart of the impossible choice and the impossible circle that the government has to square. That the government has said and agreed with the EU that there will be no hard border on the island of Ireland. And it has said that it will guarantee that by coming up with specific solutions. That's the language in the text that was agreed last year. And if there are no specific solutions, then there will be full alignment with EU rules on the single market and the customs union. So it's very hard to see how the UK is going to leave the customs union and maintain that promise on the island of Ireland, because everything we've seen so far from the UK government, the plans have been completely dismissed in Brussels as magical thinking, as six impossible things before breakfast. And it doesn't seem like we have had any movement further from that from the Brexit department. So I still think it's a huge issue that nobody knows how to solve. And I think it will be coming to the fore very soon in the Brexit process.
Well, you can follow all the latest on Brexit, as always, on theguardian.com/politics. Let's move on to a hopefully less contentious issue. 100 years on from the Representation of the People Act of 1918, Britain marked the occasion this week with speeches, memorials, and a row over whether suffragettes should be given official pardons. The Act gave the vote to some women over 30 and extended it to most men over the age of 21. It marked a watershed moment in women's rights and was extended further 10 years later. I sat down with Labour's Shadow Secretary for Women and Equalities, Dawn Butler, and asked her how she was reflecting on this week's anniversary.
It marks the date when 100 years ago, some women were given the rights to vote in a general election and be elected to this place. It's important because we should recognise the struggle that has taken place over the centuries for women to have equal rights. But we should never be complacent, because we still have a long way to go. And I think over the last, just the last few months, with the Me Too campaign, with the Time's Up campaign, it shows you that women are now gaining a voice, and they're saying we will not be silenced. And sometimes it's uncomfortable. So sometimes you have to have uncomfortable conversations. But the struggle has proven that without those uncomfortable conversations, we're never going to get to where we need to get to, and that is to have full equal rights for women, but also for women's voices to be heard, because not everybody sees the world through the same lens. So if you only have the same kind of people around the table who went to the same school, who go to the same restaurants and eat the same food, you're going to get the same responses and the same answers. And the only way we can change that is for people to be around that table who've had different life experiences and see the world through a different lens. And only then will we really represent the country that we all live in, not just a few.
And what are the levers and the mechanisms that you think politicians here need to use to try and make that happen, or to try and sort of speed up that process of those voices being heard?
So the great thing about being in this place and being a parliamentarian is that our voices are amplified louder than a lot of other voices. But it also means we make policy right here in this place. And I think that Theresa May, as a female prime minister, is wasting her tenure as Prime Minister, because she is not delivering for women. And it's a shame, because as a Shadow Minister for Women and Equalities, I have to see in my constituency, in my surgeries, I have to read the women that are writing to me to all that they're suffering under this government. You know, 86% of these government cuts are falling on the shoulders of women. That means that they're not eating sometimes. That means they can't afford sanitary products when they're on a period. That means if a mother has two daughters, She has to choose which one can go to school. This is in this day and age. This is in 2018. There's no point in being here if we're not going to make policies that are going to change people's lives and make this world better for the many and not the few.
So does that mean kind of looking at the gender impact right across government policies? I mean, things you were talking about there are sort of social policies, is the way the welfare state works. It's quite a broad thing. It's not just thinking about kind of women's issues or specific gender issues. It's making it's measuring lots of policy through that sort of lens, is it?
My three main arts are equality impact assessment. So the government needs to look at the policies that it's delivering on and needs to see how it affects different groups and communities. So if we have equality, real equality impact assessments that the Labour Party has said that we would have on each of our policies, you'll be able to see if we implement this policy, it's going to affect women more than men. It's going to affect Black, Asian, minority ethnic women more than any other group. So maybe it's not a good idea to deliver a policy in that way. Let's look how we can deliver the policy differently. So that's one of my arts of the government. The other one is period poverty. It's almost unbelievable that it happens. It's unbelievable that in our country, we have people who can't afford sanitary towels or sustainable cups or anything like that. So equality impact assessments, period poverty, and reinstating Section 40 of the Equalities Act 2010. Section 40 protected workers from harassment and abuse by third parties. It came to light because of the President's Club scandal. So where these women and young girls, some as young as 18, some of them were sexually abused. Now, Section 40 would have protected them. That was removed. But looking at the policy, I think, why on earth did they remove this section of the Act? It makes no sense. And I think, whilst we're talking about the centenary, there's no point in, like, patting each other on the back and saying, oh, yeah, look, you know, look what we did, look what happened. What are we going to do next? What's the next steps? Where are we going to go? And how are we going to protect women? What are the next steps? Let's put our money where our mouth is and let's actually make the changes. OK, we don't have women chaining themselves anymore to Parliament because we're sitting in the seats of power. What are we going to do when we've got that power? Let's do something about it.
And do you think, so Theresa May's given a speech to mark the anniversary where she's talked about kind of abuse and intimidation in public life and that's off-putting sometimes to women who want to go into public life and so on. Do you agree with her that there's more that could be done to protect women in political life as well? So she's talked about a specific offence, hasn't she? Or that's one of the proposals, isn't it, for intimidating a political candidate, for example?
100%. More needs to be done to protect women in public life, men in public life, anybody in public life. More needs to be done to protect us, because it's scary and it's frightening, and social media amplifies it all. I mean, I get so much abuse now that my office manager refuses to let anybody else open the post, because he says, I'm going to open all the posts so that you can weed it out. Some of it gets sent to the police. The police have found the DNA for one that they're now searching for. But that's where it's gotten to. I mean, I get so much abuse on Twitter. You know, I don't mind people disagreeing with me. I don't mind having an argument. But when you're rude and offensive and racist and sexist and misogynistic, then something has to be done about it. But it also means that we have a responsibility as politicians. So there's no point in Amber Rudd standing up and talking about the abuse that Diane Abbott gets, which is more than any other woman, like three times more than any other female politician. And the Tory party buys Facebook articles and billboards that encourages people to abuse Diane. So don't on one side talk about it and then add to it with the other hand. It's disingenuous and it does damage to the cause.
So you think that negative campaigning is one of the things that drives this?
Absolutely. I mean, we can campaign. We're going to have our arguments and our disagreements. And we can campaign on, we can disagree on policies. But when you start getting personal, I mean, the last general election was the most personal, besides the mayor election, which was just awful that the Tories ran against Sadiq Khan, which people will never forget because it was so vile. Besides that campaign that the Tories ran, the last election was full of abuse. Jeremy Corbyn received so much abuse from the Tories, and it was wrong, and it encouraged people to be even more abusive. And if we're serious about stamping it out, then we have to be a bit more mature in our politics, because it's so distasteful, and we know ultimately what can happen, the outcome of what can happen in the most tragic of cases.
And one more thing, Jeremy Corbyn has said, hasn't he, on this centenary, that he thinks the government should give a pardon, a historic pardon, to the suffragettes and the penalties they had to pay.
Yeah, this has been a call from, I think, 2004. There was an EDM that called for it, which Jeremy signed in 2004. And is a call of the families, etc., for this pardon. And I think if it makes the families get some kind of closure in the way that the suffragettes were treated, then the Labour Party would do that. But what's more important is the apology. And there needs to be a public apology, because, and that apology needs to come from the government, because women were sexually assaulted, they were raped, they were tortured, and that was because of their political stance of wanting women to get the vote. And so there needs to be a government apology, and the Labour Party would ensure that would happen. But I hope by the end of this year that the government will do that.
Labour's Dawn Butler there. And where do you stand on the question of whether or not to pardon individual campaigners for offences like vandalism and arson that were carried out 100 years ago or so?
I can't quite understand where this is coming from. I completely understand the campaign to pardon people who were convicted of things that are no longer offences, that are no longer illegal. But if you decide to pardon suffragettes for things they did knowing that they were against the law, and because they were against the law, then it seems to me you in some way diminish their courage and their determination. Because the cause was just, it seems to me unnecessary to absolve them from their law-breaking in pursuit of their just cause.
Jennifer, what do you think?
Well, I'm against this idea as well of a pardon for suffragettes. I think I agree with what Anna said, and I think it's deeply ahistorical to imagine that the current government, we can now rewrite the past. And also, I would really rather see that kind of attention and energy going into funding and resources for schools, so people know more about the suffrage movement, rather than this kind of measure, which just feels like a gimmick to me, and designed to sort of draw attention from more difficult and pressing questions.
And Artie, the latest research shows that women's turnout is now as high as men, sometimes better. Is it job done, do you think, for political participation of women?
No, I mean, I don't think it's job done. I mean, I would say I agree with both Anna and Jennifer that this, you know, I have sympathy with the idea that their militantism is something that should be actually celebrated and taught a lot more and worn almost as a badge of courage. It was something that they did in knowledge of what they were doing. And we do far more to recognise their sacrifices by coming out to vote, by going out to vote, by standing in elections, by working hard to achieve office, by working hard to diminish gender inequality as it stands today, than we do in issuing a pardon, which I agree with Jennifer, I see as a gimmick right now.
I really back Jennifer's point about more education, because just reading around, some of the sort of excellent books that have come out to mark the anniversary, you're reminded what an enormous shift in opinion is represented by allowing women to vote. And it's very easy to look back on it, as it always is with history, and think, well, that was going to happen. and not to understand how huge a change in all manner of attitudes about representation, about women's role, about politics was represented by that and how hard it was fought. And I think that's significant now because although it's a very different kind of shift that I can see going on in front of us in terms of attitudes to sexual harassment and to decent behaviour between sexes, nonetheless, I think there is something of the scale of perception, something of the movement in perception that's required that matches the same shift that finally allowed women to vote.
Mm. Jennifer, we've talked a lot in Britain and in Westminster about sexual harassment and also in other kind of professions and walks of life in Britain. Is that conversation that sort of sparked by the Harvey Weinstein allegations, is that going on in Brussels too? Is that are you sensing that that's a wider thing or is it a particular obsession of ours?
No, I certainly wouldn't say it's a Westminster obsession, and you can see it everywhere, including in the European Parliament as well, which did have its own Me Too debate in the wake of the Weinstein allegations, and a lot of female MEPs shared their stories of abuse and harassment, and the EU authorities, the Parliament authorities, have promised to take steps to tighten up their controls and procedures as well. So it's definitely not. It's not an isolated issue. I say it probably hasn't had the same level of attention that it has in the UK, but it is in people's minds and on the agenda.
And just flicking back to Brexit very briefly, eventually, is Theresa May going to have to sit down with Angela Merkel and woman to woman and and sort all of this out? Or is it really going to be David Davis and Ollie Robbins and Michel Barnier and the others?
Well, it's a very interesting time to be asking that question because, of course, we saw yesterday the new coalition agreement between Angela Merkel's CDU and the SPD. But I think it's worth stressing that here that the German position on Brexit has not changed at all as a result of the new government. And all along, it was never going to be Theresa May sitting with the German Chancellor, whoever that that person may be. And I think the EU have actually rather effectively created this process to sort of isolate Brexit from the rest of EU business. So, yes, I think it will be Barnier in charge most of the time. But I can imagine sort of heads of state and government will be, they're of course, keeping a close eye on the process and they'll be stepping in when things get really critical. But it won't be as sort of one leader to another, but it will be as a block of 27 versus one. And that is just the dynamic of Brexit that the UK will have to live with.
Is it significant that Martin Schulz will be, who's very keen on Macron-esque reforms and on tightening up the centre of Europe, of the EU, is it significant for us that he's going to be foreign minister?
I don't think it will be so significant. I mean, although it's true he does take a particularly sort of he does show a lot of zeal when it comes to EU integration in his statements. I don't think he's actually so far apart from Angela Merkel's CDU on when it comes to the substance. And it's also worth bearing in mind that Brexit policy is part of the Chancellery. So Merkel will continue to have a sort of close hold over that aspect of policy. But I don't think the differences between the two are actually very, very well. I think they're very united on Brexit and they're very united that they want to protect the EU's single market and the integrity of its institutions. So that's at least one question where they can agree on. And it was a very easy point in the coalition agreement. I think maybe there's one mention of Brexit, which shows you that it's actually something that for now Germany and the rest of the EU can unite on.
Oh, unlike poor Mrs. May and her cabinet. All right, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Jennifer Rankin, Anne Perkins and Artie Shankar. Follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.